Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the 481st episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and for those of you tuning in, we are recording this episode in front of an audience of students at Chapman University, where I'm a trustee professor at the Dodge College of Film and Media Arts. My guest today is a widely admired and much-beloved actor whose big-screen work now spans 30-plus years. The Los Angeles Times once asserted, quote, "He exudes a masculine and earnest accessibility, a throwback charm that harkens to an earlier Hollywood era and brings to mind names like Flynn and Gable," close quote. While GQ opined, quote, "He exudes a kind of solid decency and equanimity that makes the implausible plausible. His presence in a scene makes you believe it," close quote. All of this made him into what The Guardian described in 2008 as, quote, "one of the most bankable and audience-friendly stars in the industry," close quote. Shortly thereafter, though, he began to fade from the public eye, but never from the hearts and minds of filmgoers and filmmakers, many of whom grew up with him and were vocal about how much they missed him and yearned for his return. That, of course, has finally happened in a major way, via Darren Aronofsky's The Whale, for which this actor is now, at the age of 54, a Critics' Choice and SAG Award winner, and a Gotham and BAFTA Award nominee, and is also, for the first time in his career, up for an Academy Award. In short, welcome to the Renaissance. Would you please join me in welcoming to Chapman University, Mr. Brendan Fraser.
Everybody doing?
Welcome, and thank you so much for coming, Brendan. It's an honor to have you here, and we're all thrilled you came up. And to begin with, we always just start at the very beginning. Can you share where you were born and raised and what your folks did for a living?
I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, the year of our Lord, 1960. My father worked for Tourism Canada. Pee-wee, keep it together. Watching you. You work for me. That's my dog. We'll meet later. Anyway, Dad worked for Tourism Canada, so our family traveled. About every 3-4 years, we were going somewhere new. I realized later in life, I think that probably had something to do with why I wanted to be an actor or became one, because of your, you know, the feeling of constantly reinventing yourself or you know, getting a new group. You know, like, you know, you come back for a new year, you're making a new social group, and you become a kind of a tribe for a while, and you split up and you move on, and it's transitional. But it's kind of the life of an actor too. So it was a good one. And next question.
In addition to that, though, I believe you were you're moving around the States, but also for a time in Europe. Where is that where you sort of first were exposed to really great acting?
We lived in Europe, yes, in the Stone Ages of the 70s. Our families would take holidays to London, where I first started to see plays, and my eyes were opened. I was smitten with what was happening in the world's biggest toy box that I could imagine. And I didn't know what it was that they were doing, but I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to get up on that stage. The play that I saw that opened my eyes was Oliver, the musical, Oliver Twist. And it was about a little boy who wanted to belong. And I'm pretty sure that at some point or another in our lives, we've all felt like, you know, we wanted to belong. And again, it's kind of, that's the life of an actor. Also, you join that tribe and you become a family and then pick up, move on. You see each other down the road again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You ultimately go off in Seattle to the Actors Conservatory at Cornish College of the Arts. I believe there was somebody there named Hal Ryder, who was quite a mentor of yours. Can you tell us about what happened there and with him?
My mentor, was named Hal Ryder. He's not with us anymore, but he was a big inspiration for me to play the role of Charlie. He was a man of letters and words. He loved language. He taught text analysis, and he made classical text and iambic pentameter and, you know, all that fancy stuff that the Shakespearean guys all talk about. But it made it sound like more accessible to you and I right now. This was someone who taught us how to play objectives, have tactics to surmount obstacles, and really just get down to the brass tacks of what it is to be a trained actor. I learned a great deal from a really unique man. I hope that you all have a mentor in your life at some point or another. If you don't already, it's valuable. No matter how old you get.
So at the age of 21, it's January 1991, I believe your mom had a Chevy Spectrum. You get in that and you say, I am going from Seattle to Los Angeles.
What I said was, what's the top speed in this baby?
Was there something specific awaiting you there, or were you just going to see if there was anything to find out the answer to that?
I lived in Seattle, and I was going to drive. My plan was to go to grad school. I had a scholarship for a full tilt at SMU to, I later would learn, just pretty much teach 101 classes, but that's another story. I stayed in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, for a brief while, thinking, I'll make a little money, and things worked out. I had an audition to get to, speaking of objectives. It was for a director called Taylor Hackford, and he was directing a film called Blood In, Blood Out. It was a gang picture. You seen it, maybe?
Oh,
okay, there you go. I didn't get the job, sorry. But I did get a few phone numbers and some representation, and I decided to stay in Los Angeles, and I figured I'll learn on the job more so than I would continuing my education. This is not a good message considering the house that I'm talking to. But I heard that my name stayed on the roster for 3 years, so every time they were doing attendance, my name would get called, but I was like Ferris Bueller, and Fraser, you know, the drool. Yes, so I stayed in Hollywood.
Now, at one point, I believe there's this legendary casting director, Marion Doherty. I think pretty early on you crossed paths with her. Was there something?
Marion Doherty was she's a legend. She cast a film that I loved. It was called Slaughterhouse 5. Maybe you know it. Kurt Vonnegut, wonderful film. And she was casting a film in Seattle. It was called Dogfight. And it was with Lily Taylor. Uh-huh. Lily Taylor. And River Phoenix. It was about GIs who were shipping out to Vietnam, and they have one last night to go and get a date, but the mean rub is that it's with the ugliest girl they can find. And clearly these guys have some growing up to do, and in this story, if you haven't seen it, River's character, he does that. He falls in love with Lily, and I met River because I was cast as Sailor Number One. They cut my hair funny and gave me a costume, and we got into a brawl with the Marines, because, you know, the Marines and sailors, you know what I mean? Yeah. They threw me against a pinball machine. That's okay. Cracked a rib. Gave me an extra $50. Score. I said, I got more ribs.
Yeah.
So I got my union card from on that job.
Wow.
And that's really started the journey for me.
Yeah. Leading up to 1992, there are two films that you pretty quickly, in quick succession, appeared in that year. There was School Ties in which you play this Jewish kid in an elite boarding school in New England, 1950s New England, who tries to hide his religion from some anti-Semitic classmates. And then there's also that year Encino Man playing Link, the caveman who comes back to life in 1990s LA. These movies could not be any more different. I wonder if you can talk about, I think you auditioned for them in the opposite order than they came out, right? But how important was that, that people out of the gate saw you as somebody with that kind of range?
Lucky. Yeah. That's what it was.
Yeah.
I felt, I was resistant to do Encino Man because I was a proper actor, you see. And I had a degree in everything. And School Ties was my first film. It was quite an experience. One that I can remember probably every day of the 58 that we shot. Film subsequently, I can't remember if it was Tuesday, but I remember everything, you know, that I had to learn was right there on the job.
This was a whole generation of top young actors coming out. You, Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Chris O'Donnell. I think you've said you guys were all simultaneously going out for Scent of a Woman, which Chris got. But I mean, on that one, just Sherry Lansing, the producer, said, quote, "We were less than 4 weeks away from principal photography, and we still didn't have the boy. Brendan came into the room, very shy. We said, here are three scenes, read. And suddenly his stance changes, and this person emerges whom you can't take your eyes off of. He's like all the good ones. They become the person," close quote. So that's you reading opposite Matt Damon in probably 1991 for the movie that comes out in 1992. And then after that, or before, I'm trying now, I got to get the chronology right, but to go from that to Link or the other way, it was that way.
But then the releases were inverted.
Yes. Yes.
That's right. I had some, I guess, as I remember, there was the sound mixer on School Ties, lovely guy. His name was Keith Wester. He was a mentor of sorts to us, new actors on the scene. We were I don't know if we were billed, but we were kind of regarded as the Diner type cast.
Yeah.
From the film. Have y'all seen Diner ever? Great film.
Yeah.
It kind of introduced a
whole new wave
of 80s guys. We were the 90s guys.
Yeah. And then you and another guy who you were coming up with and who you've stayed up with is Adam Sandler, along with Steve Buscemi. We are talking about Airheads. This is 1994. Of course, a lead singer of a band that takes over the radio station.
Radio station.
Yeah. To get a shot. And I guess just, did you find, or did you feel at that time, did you have an inclination personally more towards comedy, or was that just how it sort of, for some of those early years, it seemed to be breaking that way?
I'm the least funny person I know. I don't know why everyone thinks I'm a comedian. Sincerely, I think the moment you think you're funny, you're not. You're not. Ask Adam Sandler. He's getting a Mark Twain Prize. Yeah, relax. Yeah.
So I guess the next big milestone that we should touch upon, of course, George, this man-child in the Raised by Apes, constantly banging into things. George of the Jungle, out in the summer of 1997, a rare summer non-animated family film, although inspired by an animated TV series. And I guess I just wonder what it was that you thought it would be when you signed up, because there is now a whole generation of people who
are smashing into trees.
Yeah. Well, tell us about it. Yeah, how'd you?
Then, truthfully, no, I am. For a while, their parents were stopping, going, "Oh man, I really loved you in George of the Jungle. It was such a great movie. I got a bone to pick with you. My kid needed 8 stitches." Rubber trees. George smashed into rubber trees. It was a broad comedy. We had to approach it just like you would do. I mean, I don't know how to act a cartoon. Well, maybe I do, but I just don't admit to it. But it's a world of a film. First of all, George the Jungle was a Jay Ward property, along with Fractured Fairy Tales and Rocky and Bullwinkle. And in the late 60s or early mid 70s, that was The Simpsons. You know, that was subversive humor right there. I mean, that was fighting the Cold War with backhanded jokes that got snuck in under the radar and passed all of the censors. And so, you know, it was ahead of its time in a way. You know, perfect source material for a Disney movie. Yeah.
Well, and it was also, I think, the first time that you were working in a major way with visual effects, which were really just beginning to go to a next level. What's it like acting opposite things that aren't really there?
There wasn't that much blue screen. There's a little bit. It was still kind of in its nascency and being used in a way that, you know, you believed or you won, you know, you suspended belief. But there was a day when George introduces his dog, who is an elephant named Shep. And George, the joke is George doesn't really know it's an elephant, but it's an elephant. He calls it his dog. And so George is introducing Shep to his new lady friend, Ursula. And the shot was designed to create the elephant have big blinky eyeballs like a Labrador and wiggle his ears and his tongue hang out. And to do that was very fancy computers. There were four or five technicians watching and scrutinizing every move I made, because if I reached up and pet the actual elephant past a picture plane, like right there, it would be like another $25,000. $15,000. $25,000. $85,000. Oh, I spent a lot of money that day.
Well, it's interesting how, again, throughout your career, there's this back and forth between broad comedy and intimate dramas. And an example of this, you go basically from George of the Jungle the next year to Bill Condon, Gods and Monsters, this movie, wonderful movie. You're playing the maybe slightly homophobic gardener of a gay filmmaker named James Whale, who made the Frankenstein films, in this case played by Sir Ian McKellen, who I believe was somebody you had really grown up admiring, right?
Absolutely, I did. Ian's work was what I watched at Cornish College on Beta. He did a series called Acting Shakespeare that was required to be, and that Hal turned us on to. And I'd seen it forwards and backwards and always admired him a great deal. When I came to town, he was doing Richard III, and there was a part in it that I went up for, but I did not get it. However, I did get a really nice note card from him that said, well, we could certainly use some of your enthusiasm, see you down the road, that kind of thing. And I actually did.
That's awesome.
So,
yeah.
That was a fulfillment in a big way. Clayton Boone is the name of that character. It was a film that was based on a novel called Father of Frankenstein. And James Whale was the creator of such incredible films as Bride of Frankenstein. Frankenstein was his beautiful creation, was James Whale's creation. And the character was this moody... I think today we call them toxic, masculinely toxic, toxically masculine kind of guy who learned to be a man. What he thought what it meant to be was completely the opposite because of this sort of oddball friendship that this film was about. Two people who really shouldn't be friends were the best of friends. So it was a very sweet story and I think an important one too. And one I should tell you that none of the studios wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. They're like gay director.
You anticipate. No,
seriously, they didn't want. And Bill Condon was like a bulldog with the movie, and he took it to then a little known distribution company in Vancouver, BC, that was named after a bridge called Lion's Gate. And so Gods and Monsters launched Lion's Gate.
That's true. Yeah. And this was $4 million indie shot in just 24 days.
It was like we had t-shirts that said $2.8 million in 28 days, nothing but airplanes over right. there. Like, really.
But it is amazing what you're saying.
We rolled out. We ran out of film, actually, you know.
But it's kind of amazing that just 25 years ago, what we're talking about is a situation where this movie can go to Sundance, be a hit, and then not really have any luck with a distributor. Here's what McKellen said, quote, "It was a film about a gay man starring a gay man that was written and directed by a gay man," close quote. Essentially, like, good luck selling that. And yet, when it did get eventually picked up and shown, best film of the year from the National Board of Review, great response to you and Sir Ian. He gets an Oscar nomination in the category that you are now nominated in. It's just kind of a nice moment.
I just saw Ian recently. He moderated a chat of a screening of The Whale in London, and we didn't talk about The Whale. We just chat with each other. I hadn't seen him in, you know, it's been a minute. He's still the same. Very cheeky, very funny, really sweet guy.
So one of the things that I've noticed, I know I'm not the only one, between School Ties, Encino Man, Dudley Do-Right, Blast from the Past, in which you're playing this guy who comes out of a nuclear shelter after 35 years. I mean, it seems like you are often asked to play outsiders who are trying to fit in. Now, you mentioned your childhood, that there was some element of that in your own life. Do you think that's just a coincidence, or do casting directors see something? What is that about?
Maybe a little of each. I can identify with being the new guy. You know, a lot of those characters were the babe in the woods. They were the naif, the new guy in town. David Green was from School Ties. He just really wanted to fit in and get along, and he had to make a decision about if or not he could own who he is, where he would hide that in the face of the anti-Semitism that he was confronted with. And he learned a lesson about himself. It came at a cost, you know, like life, but he took ownership of his life, and that was his journey. So he was like a new guy in town trying to get along. And in a lot of ways, Linkovich Chomovsky from Encino Man, he was a pretty new guy in town too. You know, wheezing the juice isn't that easy. You got to get somebody to do that for you. I think a lot of those characters felt like, you know, they were the ones who didn't know what to expect until it happened.
Right.
And either whether it was accident or design, I could identify with that.
Yeah. This brings us to 1999 and The Mummy. Rick O'Connell, American adventurer, stumbles upon a burial site in Egypt and unleashes all sorts of insanity. This was so huge, $416.4 million worldwide. I think you probably reached more people with one movie than everything up to that point. I don't know. I think George of the Jungle was pretty big too, but just what drew you to that, where it would obviously end up being three films, maybe still to be added to, we'll see. But what was the draw for you there?
Steven Sommers was inspired by films like Jason and the Argonauts and the Sinbad movies and pretty much anything that Ray Harryhausen did. And he loved big adventures and swashbuckling, and he wrote this incredible screenplay that took the conceit of what we thought The Mummy was, of some boring old guy going, he's wrapped up in bandages, and he's like, no, it's going to be like Jaws and Terminator Monster, mummies, can't stop him, it's going to be awesome. And we all thought, okay, we had no idea what kind of movie we were making. We didn't know if it was a adventure movie, a horror picture, like a romance, a straight ahead action picture, all of it. And if you look at the first film, you can see editorial choices that kind of bleed over into the edges of, they didn't really know either. Mm-hmm. So its audience kind of found that movie, and it became an audience champion. So, you know, if it worked once, why not come back and do it again? So
right.
We made The Mummy Returns.
Yes. Now that was 2001. Yeah. And you have said, though, that after that one, this is your phrase, I couldn't get arrested. Why was that? What was going on?
Hollywood's a real hot and cold, really fickle surreal place sometimes. And honestly, it's like a heat-seeking missile. You know, when you're hot, you're on target. If you're not, you're out of sight, out of mind. And I know a thing or two about that. Mm-hmm. Any actor is going to go through that. The phone's going to stop ringing. You're going to wonder who your agents, where they are, you know. And that's part of the drill, is the challenge of deciding if or not you're going to stay in this. And how many filmmakers are we here in the house? Just show of hands, clapping, shouting. So many. Okay, you know what I'm talking about. We're family then, okay? You got to stay in the game. You really do. And persistence and preparation and maybe a little dumb luck can help. But hang on to whatever it is that really got you excited about why you want to be a part of this. And you go through the bumps and things pick up, they slow down. But if you love what you do, it doesn't feel like a job anymore.
We will note that in between the second and third Mummy films, that means between 2001 and 2008, you were in several wonderful, more art house kinds of movies that I want to ask you about. I don't know if this first one I'm going to mention may have been, the ball might have been rolling even before the second Mummy, but I know there was a bit of delay because of world events. But can you talk about The Quiet American, which is sure. One of the great performances, I think, of yours. And it's you opposite Michael Caine. This is an adaptation of a 1955 Graham Greene novel that had been made into a movie before in 1958. And now it's you, Michael Caine, and in a love triangle with a Vietnamese woman.
The Quiet American is an indictment of American foreign policy as it was written. Graham Greene was asked famously why it's called The Quiet American, and he responded, because he's dead. it's all there in the title. The film that we shot was shot in Vietnam. Philip Noyce was the director, and it was in 2001. The story itself is one of Vietnamese culture's, it's their story. It's their national story. They fought the French. They just before the Americans showed up and said, "Hey, let's talk about this." And it's a triangle. I agree with you. With Thomas Fowler, played by Michael Caine, is the world weary European, seen it all, done that journalist who files every now and then just to stay in the job because he's really enjoying his time in Saigon. He has a girlfriend, and she is beautiful and perfect and silent and intelligent and wiser than he gives her credit for. And in walks this hapless American with great ideas about how to make it all a better place. And this love triangle ensues, and you quickly learn that whereas these two men think that they've got one over on her, they're fighting over her, she's playing them against each other like a rented piano. And it's a fantastic book. If you know it, read it again. I was so happy to be a part of it because of the gravity of the material. We worked in locations that were, for instance, there was one scene, I think there's a clip of it, they showed in the reel where there was a car bombing that goes off. There's an event, a terrorist event, and it set in a lot of events in motion, and one thing turned to the next, and battles ensued. And we shot really on the location that something like that happened in the 1950s. And while we were there, I there was somebody from the embassy, from the American embassy, who introduced me to a man, and he had a bit of French. I have a little bit of French, and I could speak to him. It turned out, he said, I worked right over on that street over there. I was on my bicycle. I was going to see my uncle, and I was delivering laundry, I think is what he said, and he heard a horrible sound, and he got off his bicycle, and he saw this aftermath. So I say this because of the following reason. When this film came to market, and it was a Miramax production. There was a garden variety screening of The Quiet American on September 10th, and the team was going to go get notes at the offices the next morning, and they saw the whole thing. So the film went on ice, or the chopping block. The owner of the film was somebody who's in jail now for a really long time. Mm-hmm. You can clap. He actually told me in this ear, he said, I want you to malign me to the press. I want you to make me out to be the big bad ogre under the bridge. And go figure, right? Sir, I'm not going to do that. But he thought, no, we'll make this a cause celebre, because he didn't want to market the film because he didn't want to do what he thought was wrong for the American people. And a piece ran in the Washington Post that was titled, Let the Quiet American Speak. And it was essentially saying, hey, look, we're not children. Why can we not see this film, Miramax? Thankfully, Michael Caine took it to Toronto for the Toronto International Film Festival, and God bless the Canadians. they gave it a standing ovation, and it went on to receive a lot of good recognition and also an Oscar nomination
for Michael Caine in this category again. So you're good company. But the other one that I mentioned in that time period that I raised, Crash, which was a film in which you play the district attorney of Los Angeles married to a woman played by Sandra Bullock. These guys are carjacked, which is a traumatic event for them. Then their home, the locks are changed, and she's still affected by this. And you guys, it's just sort of, the whole movie is about the ricochet effect, I guess, of traumatic incidents and bigotry. And
the obvious racial tension that existed in Los Angeles.
Yes.
That it did. It's a film. It's a product of its time. I haven't watched it recently. I don't know if it holds up. Your film students, have y'all seen Crash at all? I mean, I think there are themes that are still relevant. You don't get everything right or wrong, but the intention was there to open a dialogue and to extend an open hand and say, hey, look, we're all scared. We can talk about this. And it was made as to make a step in the right direction. I think we can build on that from where we are now. So one of you smart young whips, go out and make another Crash, would you?
Were you there the night that it won the Best Picture Oscar? It was one of the more surprising moments, and nothing against
you're telling me. No, I was not there. I was in Mexico City working on a film called The Air I Breathe, and
yes,
I was working with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah,
my friend Sarah.
Yeah,
the SMG. I call her the submachine gun. You know. Halo was really big in those days. Right. Dual wielding. I know. I'm cool. We were in a shot maker, which is, you know, a flatbed. You put the vehicle on it and you drag it around the place, and it looks like you're driving, but you're really not. And we were in Mexico City. We were going around the Victoria Monument in the middle of town, and it's downtown Mexico City late at night. And I look out the window and I see this wheel just like, what the shit was that? Sure enough, the wheel came off the back of the trailer. We're in Mexico City. Stuff happens, you know?
Yeah.
And so we pulled over, and Sarah, to fix it, I guess, somebody went and found the wheel. And she looks at her phone, this Nextel phone. She's like, oh, look, it won. You won for Best Picture for Crash. We're like, yeah, great, awesome. I'm here with a flat tire in Mexico City. But we made the best of it because there was a mariachi band on every corner.
There you go.
You just give them $50, party time, instantly. So we had cervezas and really big guitars and large hats, and we sang all the way back to the...
That's great.
Yeah, we had our own party.
Well, so by the time of The Third Mummy in 2008, you were a pretty physically beaten up guy, right? Can you talk... You've said that this led to 7 years of hospital visits. Can you tell us what
happened? Sure. Well, it's a tall guy thing, for one, you know, the knees and the hinges and the joints, tall guys, you feel me? combination of that, probably trying too hard at work on the job, not working smart, but working too hard. Mm-hmm. And I guess I threw myself into the parts a little more vigorously than I really knew that I needed to. I can remember doing Airheads and Joe Mantegna, seeing how excited we were getting because we were going to get to jump off of the thing into the crash mat down below. And he's like, yeah, just settle down. Let the stunt guys do this. And we're like, no, no, let's do it. And so we did the thing. We jumped off. And sure enough, Adam went and just jacked his neck up and everything like that. Oh, I know. But you're made of plasticine. You're fine. You bounce a little. You know, you come back, and this stuff catches up with you. Anyway, so long story short, yeah, I needed to get some work done. It took a while. It was a hospital. You know, it's kind of like painting your house. I don't like this room. Paint it this color.
Now there were those injuries. And then when you were nice enough to be a part of our Hollywood Reporter Actor Roundtable not long ago, you spoke about a moment on a movie called Furry Vengeance in 2010. You're playing a guy who wants to clear a forest in the Pacific Northwest for development, but he's thwarted by the animals that live there. And this culminates, in a way, in a scene.
Hilarity ensues.
Yeah. But I guess in all seriousness, you sort of felt there was a moment.
I did. First of all, don't work with animals. I had an epiphany. I was in a porta potty. I was being chased by a bear. The bear inverted the porta potty with me in it. Hilarity ensued. And I remember feeling very small and uncomfortable. And I had a little talk with myself, and I thought, maybe this isn't for me right now. So I left the broad comedy for a while, and I don't remember what I did next. I think the business changed a little bit, and I started working in episodic television.
Yeah.
Which is cool. I had a really great run with a show called Trust.
Yes.
That was on FX. It was about the Getty family. And I was the fixer.
And that came out of The Affair, which you'd been on season 3 of The Affair.
Also that. I love The Affair because, do y'all know the show at all?
That's great.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a Rashomon story. You see the story from whoever character's perspective is a little bit different. They were dressed a little differently. Different things happen. So there's a great deal of flexibility with story structure that the producers indulged me to contribute ideas, and I started getting some confidence back, and it was a good show.
In those, you know, quote unquote leaner years, you never stopped working. You were never went away. Like people say, where would you go? I know you make sure to tamp that down, because it's not, I guess there's some people who felt like, had you lost your love for acting, or was it just, no. So what was your experience, rather than letting other people characterize it during those years?
Hey, look, I don't care what they say as long as they're saying something.
Yeah.
I feel like it was a time that I just needed to regenerate, regroup, have a think, have a family, kids, all that, and really put value where I needed it most. And I was never that far away. I mean, I think I'd go bonkers if I wasn't doing something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a great deal to be acknowledged or said that, you know, once you're, like I said earlier, once you're out of sight, you're out of mind. And it's those lean periods that you're going to have to deal with as an actor, no matter what. Mm-hmm. Or as a writer, or as a director, you know. You'll find out.
I've got one last project to ask you about before The Whale, and that is one that I believe was shot right after The Whale, but may have been intended for release before it. However, it has not, and it doesn't appear that it will see the light of day, and that is a project from HBO Max called Batgirl, in which you were the pyromaniac villain.
I did my job.
Firefly. Just for people, because this is, you know, I guess the business is always changing, and this may be in some ways indicative of a new direction some places are going in. Can you just explain for people who don't know, like, what exactly happened there?
No, I don't know the exactitude. Is that the word? Yeah. Who am I kidding? It was about saving money. The film was, Leslie Grace was fantastic. I'm sad that this film won't come out because of how terrific she really was in this part. I was there. I saw it. She was really, really good. Really cool. And it pains me to think that little girls are going to have to wait a lot longer now before they can see a Batgirl who they can identify with and say, hey, she looks like me. You know, I want to be her. It was a really empowering story in that way. It really was. Adilan Bilal, who did the Bad Boy movies, shot it. They're really good at blowing shit up. And they love doing it. They're so good at it. They love practical effects. I personally dislike pyrotechnics. They love them. And my character is called Firefly. He's the firefighter. He was a good character. He was, I thought he was really cool. I liked him. He was sympathetic in an interesting way. He was a vet who fought in the Gulf War. He helped put out oil derricks that were aflame as Saddam Hussein escaped in cowardice back to Baghdad. And he knew what he was doing, you know, with flashbangs and things that go boom. And he got out of the service. His benefits got cut. And he was very angry about that. And, you know, he's a bad guy. He's got a screw loose. But what's he going to do but burn Gotham to the ground? And I thought it was a cool character with some social consciousness snuck in there at the same time. So, you know, I was all in. And again, like, and Leslie was just fantastic. I don't know. Look, you know, it was formatted for, it was shot, conceived of, and created for the streaming service on HBO. And, you know, right now, for those of you all know, there's kind of a horse and cart or internal combustion engine kind of debate going on about, you know, where are we in filmmaking? We have 3x5 screens. We have massive ones like this. There's no excuse to not see anything. Content, content, content. Too much content, you know. With the case with Batgirl, I think it was the canary in the coal mine to see if or not this streaming platform really is a viable business model. I'm really getting in over my head with this economic stuff. But nice. In brief, in the end, it was a business decision from what I understand. That's just like reading your magazine, reading your publication too. Yeah.
Well, this brings us to a film that this audience has just seen here. But for our listeners, I will describe that in Darren Aronofsky's The Whale, you play Charlie, this obese man who teaches English online and is trying to reconnect with his estranged daughter. This is a film that Darren Aronofsky has been wanting to make for, I believe, over a decade since he saw Samuel Hunter's play. In a weird way, it's maybe even more timely now than when it came out, because we all have a sense of isolation that we're familiar with through the pandemic, I think. And I know that's something that perhaps you'll want to weigh in on. But I just wonder, to begin with, do you know, Darren has said basically that the reason it took so long from his point of view was that he was unable to find somebody who he believed could live up to this difficult part, and until he came upon something of yours that made him reconsider that. And I can you share if he's told you what he saw and then how you found out that he was interested in you?
Well, the word on the street was Darren was going to make a movie. Everybody wants to get in on that. I mean, it's mm-hmm. Darren Aronofsky. He's mm-hmm. world-class filmmaker. Offers up no easy answers to the thornier questions he asks of his audience about the human condition, dares you to look away. He's a very courageous, artistic cineast. And I will admit to no small measure of creative intimidation when I met him at first. He was a gentleman, and he was quite forthright about the task he had to create Charlie. Charlie is a unique character. He's a man whose body weighs hundreds and hundreds of pounds. He is not who he is as he presents. He's a father. He's an educator. He was a husband. He's a man. And He was someone that in a character that Darren saw and thought, this is someone who you would easily dismiss or disregard. And for that, he wanted to know more about who this man is at home. And we see his world, this dim two-bedroom apartment in Anywhere, Idaho, where Charlie lives. And somehow inside of the world of this little apartment, he's like a beacon of light. He's like a lighthouse at sea. And this was the conversation that we had when we first met.
Which was the result of, just to quickly document it, he had, of all things, seen a trailer for your 2000...
Oh, yeah, he saw a picture called Journey to the End of the Night I did with Scott Glenn.
Back in 2006.
That's right.
So I guess there's a quick lesson is you never know what's gonna be the thing that really matters, right?
I guess you got to bring your A game all the time because you never know who's going to see what work you do, you know? And hey, if that got Darren to pay attention and go, hey, Brendan Fraser's still alive? Like, then, you know, get him in here. And again, he had a challenge in casting this role. He had looked for, as he says, 10 years. He looked at all manner of A-list actors, unknowns, people from overseas, European actors, and he didn't see what he needed. And he attested that he thought, well, okay, this is the one that gets away in his career. And I guess I'm making myself the hero of his story, but we met. Yeah. And I knew I wanted to be a part of this project for the gravity that it had and the story it had to tell about redemption and love. And I felt like I knew Charlie and my mentor, and I knew versions of him, an amalgamation. Can I just ask you, do y'all know, like, do y'all have a Charlie in your life? He's familiar. I felt like he was a friend, you know, and as a little actor, woo-woo, but I really wanted to get to know this guy. I wanted to play this part. And the only way to know him properly was to invest everything I could in this job and in this character. And it was no small feat because of how his body needed to be created. And he had a real nuts and bolts attitude about it. He said, we're going to do this with prosthetics, just in the same way that you would see a film that had a creature or a monster, you know, whatever like that. This was a suit performance in that regard. Adrian Moreau is the name of the makeup artist who's also nominated this year for an Oscar for his work. He's extraordinarily talented, and he has been experimenting. He had been experimenting for some time with 3D printing appliances by creating the molds to skip a step. There's no life cast in that case. In other words, you know, you get your actor, whoever it is, alive there, and you pour goop on your face, and then from that you make a bust, and then you put horns on it or whatever you want, and then from that you make a mold. But a step is skipped because I was scanned with an iPad in my driveway. That information went to Montreal, where he was working in the studio. He created Charlie virtually. He treated his entire body like a texture map, so he could zoom in on the size of pores, anomalies in the skin, everything. So much detail. And that's essential, because if we didn't use practical prosthetic makeup to create this properly, an audience will never believe this character. I mean, a number of years back, I did a film called Bedazzled, and in it, Elliot plays seven different lives, and there was prosthetic makeup in there. It was a broad comedy, and we've come a long way since then. So to create Charlie, it had to be impeccable, and something that when you see him at first, it's arresting, and you go, wait, is that the guy from George of the Jungle? Is he like, you know, what's he watching on his laptop? You're like, oh, good. And once that surprise goes by, you feel like you know this guy, and you're not distracted by any perceived artifice that comes with, a faulty makeup.
And just so people know, because there are, just as a process question, Ryan, you're there every day for how long in the makeup chair as this comes to life?
Adrian got there an hour before I did, so he'd be there at 3, I'd get there at 4. We usually had an 8:30 or 9 o'clock call, depending on what we were doing. So it was 4 hours in the chair. Why am I laughing?
And this,
because he's a great guy. We became really fast friends and watched a lot of YouTube videos. I think our favorite ones were that week. Korean street food. there's exciting things they're doing with eggs in Korea, let me tell you. many eggs.
I think people should realize, though, that in order to not do what has so often been done in movies, which is a kind of demeaning, just quote-unquote fat suit, you guys are, in some cases,
that's
here,
a term that you'll never hear me say, and I'm not calling you out.
No, I said, yeah.
Not, but the film is about, in many ways, the bias that we hold against those who live with obesity and the vernacular that we use. That's still common parlance. I mean, there's terminology that we have retired that has no place being spoken of. And I think terminology that can lean into the bias against those who live with it actually is harmful to people. I do know that how we speak to one another and of one another has a lasting effect, and definitely not just mental health side effects, but physical ones too, clearly. I worked with the Obesity Action Coalition, who are an advocacy group who number tens of thousands of members, and they support those who live with obesity, their families, referrals. If you need a resource to look towards, I would point you in that direction. Anyway, their mission is to change these prevailing attitudes. If we accept that the shaming that comes along with a person who lives with obesity is, to my understanding, almost like the last refuge of prejudice that we still abide. And I think we could do better to change that. So this was a film that can change hearts and minds from what I could see after we finished it. And I can tell you right now at the OAC, the Obesity Action Coalition, the number of inquiries have gone up since this film has come out, which means that where people were formerly unwilling to ask for help, they are now. People are saying, I'm going to make a change, or I'm going to get that procedure. And I think that's, it does my heart good, but I firmly believe that Charlie's a character that, as they say, could save lives. You know?
Totally. Well, when you and Darren were first speaking, there was some acknowledgement of the fact that he is previously with the wrestler, you could say, reintroduced an actor. In that case, it was, of course, Mickey Rourke.
Great. Yeah. Yes, that wasn't lost on me. Natalie also. She was doing fine for her professional life, but she was definitely reintroduced.
Natalie Portman in Black Swan.
Interesting that the wrestler and Black Swan were both... they were both thematically perform or die as themes, I think that's speaks on a base level to anyone creative in a way. And Darren does have a sense of humor, by the way.
But this idea of being reintroduced, as you said, you never went away, but maybe, I guess this was in your first sizable part since 2013. I think it's in I don't want to say every part's, but that's maybe the wrong word, but it was maybe the first lead of a film of this size. I don't know how to put it, but, was that a thing that you embraced, this idea of being reintroduced?
Oh, absolutely. Look, we all lived under existential threat, if we're honest about it. Someone who's very clever, I feel, is in the house right now who should write a paper, and I want to tell you about this. Yeah. I want to pitch it to you. Please, someone, have a think about the films that were made between 2019 and early 2022. And see if you can find a thread that connects them all. I have an idea about what it might be, and that is this. Stay with me. Because of the lockdown and the pandemic and the circumstances that we lived under and that we felt there might, well, not be a tomorrow or next week, we would either retreat and stay home as well we should, reasonably, or when it was time to emerge again and go off into the world and do what we do as humans, as professionals, et cetera, we had to be really careful about that. And in films, I notice a translucence or something about that connects the stories that have all been told during this period. And I think that it is because of the care that we had for one another, certainly to get the protocols in place for you guys to come back to school even, and for us to do our jobs on sets. It meant extra concern for one another. And maybe this is just me thinking about it too much, but I really think that's the secret ingredient in a lot of films that we've seen between 19 and 22. There's a feeling of we might as well give it everything we've got because there might not be a tomorrow. We might not be invited back to do this again, perceptibly. And at the same time, it's a risk that you take in art, not in life. I believe in taking risks because going towards that edgy danger area creatively is where a lot of the best growth will come from. I think that's what happened. Did I just write the paper I pitched you? Someone please do better. I'm bad at spelling.
We'll get it to you if and when that's actually turned in. But one final question from me before we turn it over to the students, Brendan. This film, I don't know where you saw it for the first time, but we saw you seeing it after you'd seen it in public for the first time. This was at the Venice Film Festival, where it received a 6-minute standing ovation, understandably leaving you quite moved. Then the film goes into theatrical platform release, and it had the best limited theatrical release of 2022 per theater average. Then goes on to all sorts of acclaim that I've started at the top mentioning, but also now 3 Oscar nominations, not just yourself for Best Actor, but also Hong Chau for Best Supporting Actress, and Adrian Moreau and his team for Best Hairstyling and Makeup. So my final question to you is, what has this last, I guess, 6 months been like for you to see the response to your work and also to yourself personally? It seems like, in a way that is not at all common, people are really excited and thrilled to have you back.
I'm humbled. I don't know what else to say. I'm grateful. It's affirming. I think we made a film that's really reaching people in a meaningful way. That's the hope, you know? No one deliberately sets out to make something that sucks, but you know, sometimes you don't have control over how things are received. And this is a film that has spoken to people. It's opened hearts and minds, and also a dialogue. The number of men and fathers who I've met in the last 6 months or so who told me that's my relationship with my daughter. I want to go and reapproach it in a new way to mend fences. There's some healing that's coming of the drama that we see on the screen. So that's what's most rewarding to me.
That's great. We are now going to hand some mics to students, and then we're going to come over here.
Hi, my name is Sebastian, big George of the Jungle fan, so thank you. So I don't know if you heard, but Ki Hui Kwan came in yesterday to do a masterclass, and I know this has been kind of like a big comeback year for the two of you with The Whale and Everything Everywhere All at Once. So could you kind of describe your relationship in this award season with him?
Sure. Ki and I were in Encino Man together. Did you know that? It's true.
31 years ago.
Right. He ran the computer club. I was the new guy. And there were two dudes who were kind of not being cool to him. And I said, come be my friend. And that's how we met on screen. 30 blah, blah, years later, I ran into him in the office of a building for
our round table.
Your chat, yes. Yeah. I was like, brother,
yeah.
we're still here, man. Yeah. He's like, yeah, we are. We're still here. You can't get rid of us. Can I just tell you, I knew that he was here last night. You know why? Because there's a googly eye. Right. It's mine now.
That's great.
Hi, I'm Macy. My question is, I feel like all of us as aspiring filmmakers, or at least myself, view the collaborative process from sort of like a straight and narrow angle. And I just feel like it's important to know from you as an actor, what qualities you value and look for in the people that you work with and the projects that you choose to sign on to.
I think it depends on the project. You know, The Whale was a play. It was a stage production that Darren saw in 2012. He optioned the rights, Samuel D. Hunter, and they worked on it for 10 years to try and get it made. We did. To understand our job, we rehearsed for 3 weeks. A24 gave us 3 weeks. That's unheard of, but they did. And Darren declared us a theater company on day one. The set was taped out one-to-one and standby props and furniture, and we watched one another's scene work. We made our mistakes. We made our discoveries. We bonded. We gained our confidence, found our voice. So by the time we had actually gone through the rehearsal, and he and Maddie Libatique, a cinematographer, figured out where to put the camera, inspired a lot of really good shots just through that rehearsal process. I can give you one example. Do you remember when Ellie first comes into Charlie's apartment and she's kind of casing the place and she's real cagey and she walks around behind Charlie and she knows that he can't turn his head. So when we were rehearsing, Sadie went around back because she wanted to see if she could make me really uncomfortable. And it worked. And so that inspired, you know, that long lens shot of just the back of Charlie's head with glimpses and glances trying to find her in the room. I think the best answer is that you need people who are dedicated to a common vision. And if they're not, don't work with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Find your people. You will. You will.
Hi, I'm Nick, and I'm curious, when you're filming something like The Whale with that emotional weight, what's the demeanor like on set, and how do you, as the lead actor, like, step out of Charlie's shoes after you're done and not take that with you?
Good question. Well, it was like this. Hong Chau is incredible as a performer. I think she has more in her face that she can convey without speaking a line of dialogue. She can say more in between lines and the pauses and the silences than, you know, she can by reading the proper lines themselves. I felt connected with her as a best friend character, and that bond that she and I had is apparent in the relationship that you see on screen. It felt emotionally challenging, as it should have been. And again, I think it's part and parcel from the circumstances of shooting in kind of a submarine ship kind of environment, so tight and close on top of one another. There's a great deal of trust there. The emotional reality of this story is right on the surface, is sometimes hard to look away from, as well it should be. And by the day's end, when I could have all the costume and makeup taken off, which took about an hour, an interesting thing happened. I wasn't anticipating the cumbersome nature of the appliances. Made, you know, your body reacts, and I started developing, you know, unique, weird muscles that you don't, you know, when you put your skates on, you take them on, you're like, oh. Yeah, I kind of got good at wearing the suit. And when it came off, I kind of felt a sense of vertigo. And I was like, what's going on? You know, I think it was an experience that was giving me a unique opportunity to understand what it really feels like to be that person. And it stayed with me. I'll tell you, when the show was done and the last time it all came off, I had an emotional response that I was not anticipating. I felt quite overwhelmed in a way. Like, I was saying goodbye to a friend, or, you know, I don't mean to get too in my head about this to answer your question, but the truth was, I gave it everything that it had, and I had no other moves to spare. And I felt like that I owed it to this guy. So it was a little bit of just really investing in the work as much as I could, and allowing myself to be changed by it at the same time.
Hi, hello.
I would be doing my classmates a disservice if I did not ask you about Looney Tunes Back in Action.
Shoot.
My question is, with such a star-studded cast like a former Bond or Steve Martin, what was it like sharing the screen with such Hollywood heavy hitters as Daffy Duck and Bugs
Bunny? He's an asshole.
That's all about Daffy. Pages out of the script. And then goes trailer.
Right. Bugs is actually a really cool guy. Seriously. Everything you've heard about him is true.
Hi. Who do you think would win in a wrestling match, Lemmy or God?
Trick question. Lemmy is God. But nice try. If it's too loud, you're too old. Airheads.
Hi, I'm Ellis. So I was wondering if you have a particular method or a set of techniques or anything like that that you like to use when you're preparing for a role, and if maybe that's a little different when you're playing someone like George of the Jungle versus someone like Clayton in Gods and Monsters or Charlie in the Whale.
I think the bottom line is you have to believe what you're doing, because if you do not, your audience will not either. We can create any image. We can do anything if you can imagine it. It can be on a screen. And you know that. You're students. It's what you do. You're the next generation. I'm excited for you. You're going to find so many cool things to bring to this screen. We need you. Keep doing what you're doing. Anyway, I digress. Believe in what you're doing. I think the character's requirements for George of the Jungle. Yes, I watched a lot of cartoons. Yes, I went to the gym a lot. No, I didn't wear much clothing at work. It was the job.
Yeah.
To prepare for that, it was just all about energy. For to do Charlie, again, I had to believe in who he was and do the research that comes with understanding his world and trust actually just really in the process, and in this case in the director to guide us. The best directors are the ones who just kind of go, it's over there. You know, they direct you. Just go over there and you'll find where you need to be. And occasionally there are those who do that even better. And Darren's definitely one of them, yeah.
My name's Mackenzie. I just wanted to say me and my mom love With Honors. So it's just a fantastic film. And my question was, working with so many different actors, has anyone ever given you advice that you have taken with you, like, through your career?
Yeah. Ian McKellen, in some conversation, left me with, you need to approach the work as if it's the first and the last time that you ever will. You know, think about that.
That's great.
That stayed with me. That and be good, be brief, be seated.
Please join me in thanking Brendan so much for coming up here and being so generous with
Thank
your
you,
time.
Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. and to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @awardschatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.